be covering the Republican National Convention tonight, 10 o'clock, with analysis and reaction to tonight's speakers, Make America Work Again. The topic of the convention day two is the economy. We'll have Charles Lipson, Chris Roebling, Congressman Holmgren, who's part of the Illinois delegation, who's there. We'll talk about their vote today. Also talk with Paris Schutz, who will join us from Chicago tonight. So lots to talk about day two of the RNC that's coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, Abraham Leviton joins me now. He's the man behind Nerds on Tour, the podcast that talks to musicians about the music industry. Tonight we start our monthly, or just start, we start, this is really our third. I don't know why I say start.
This is the lucky one, number three.
Lucky number three. This is our monthly segment about different issues for both artists and consumers when it comes to the music industry. Abraham's a Chicago musician in front of the band Baby Teeth. He also did Shame That Tune at the Hideout, and his company Piano Power. It's all about providing in-house lessons from real artists who teach the students what they want to play. Abraham, good to see you.
Great to see you, Justin. We're doing it.
It was a little early tonight, too, 8 o'clock. All right, so let's talk about this. The big issue in music right now has to be, surprisingly, licensing. As we saw the band Queen, Brian May goes to Twitter and said, "I told you once, stop using our music." You see bands over and over and over on both sides of the aisle essentially telling politicians on the campaign trail and at conventions, stop using our stuff. Do they have a point? Or do they have a legal leg to stand on?
It turns out that their point is only an aesthetic point. And you leave it to Trump to throw out the playbook and to really explore the truth behind the issue. This has been going on for years. And the Republicans are always the ones who get busted for this. They pick a classic rock song, whether it's Reagan using Born in the USA,
right,
whether it's George W. Bush using I Won't Back Down by Tom Petty, and then the classic rocker always starts beating their chest and saying, "That is my work. Stand down, Republican."
Not for you.
Right?
Right, right.
And then they back down, and it's over. Aha. Until Trump, who was the first to say, "I won't back down,"
right,
in the
right,
words
right.
Of Mr.
Petty. It was
Queen,
not Tom Petty, but go ahead.
"I am a champion," in the words of Queen. And he just said,
well, if people came out today and said, "You know what, actually, legally, we license everything through, you know, the idea of broadcast, live broadcast on television. So it doesn't matter if Queen, you know, protests. It doesn't matter if Sony Music protests. They have a legitimate legal right to use the music."
Yeah, and I was such a simpleton. I always thought that if the classic rocker waved their arms and said, "Stop, stop, stop," that the politician would have to stop. And it took Trump to say, "I will show you the law. I am the law."
I am the law. It was Law and Order night, right? So
was it?
It kind of worked out for him. But this is, I mean, this is something that politics and music, especially when it comes to using music for promotional purposes, they've been, like you said, I mean, they've been at odds, and we've seen the weirdest songs being used. We saw Don't Stop Thinking About Them. We saw Fleetwood Mac for Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
Obama kind of took a safe route with Stevie Wonder. I think he'd signed, sealed, and delivered.
Right.
But, you know, all eyes now kind of shift to what Trump's song's going to be when he walks off the stage at the RNC on Thursday. Because, you know, I think it'd be something else if he comes out and says, if he comes out with We Are the Champions or something by Queen again after they have publicly said, don't use it.
It's got to be. It's got to be We Are the Champions again, because that is so Trump. I mean, Trump, essentially, his slogan is not Make America Great Again. It's Screw You. And anytime anybody has challenged him on anything, he doubles down.
Yeah, he
is the double down master.
So is this something that, I mean, at first glance, I'm like, okay, well, I thought it was possible that Sony Music or Warner Brothers Music, whoever owned it, licensed it out. Now that this is out there and more artists and politicians know that there's really that nothing that can be done, what are we going to see a bunch of music being that not being a concern anymore and musicians standing down, or are they going to flare up even more and protest the fact their music's being used?
Well, I mean, there's only one party to watch with this stuff, right? It's Republicans. I mean, Democrats
do it, but they never get called on it. Right?
They never get called on it because by and large, artists are left leaning. Mm-hmm. And they're flattered. And, you know, oh, of course Obama can use my song. Of course Clinton can use my song. But the Republican pool of rockers is basically like Ted Nugent and Meatloaf.
Sammy Hagar. Right. There's a lot in
small.
There. Oh. I mean, that's a good 20, 25 songs you can use.
I'm not sure if that would be a full Spotify playlist.
I can't drive 55 over and over and over. That could work. So that's one issue that's playing out right now. And it is interesting because music plays a big role when it comes to these protests that are outside the conventions, both the Republican and the Democrat. We know the Prophets of Rage, Tom Morello and Cypress Hill and those kind of bands are playing. We've seen bands play big shows. There really is almost a market for the music when it comes to conventions.
Yeah, again, I mean, if you're on the right side, or the left side, I should say, because Democrats seem to have this unlimited pool of, oh, this is an anti-Republican rally? We're going to get top-of-the-line talent to play this. And as soon as you cross over to the Republican side, it's like tumbleweeds.
It really is. Abraham Levitan in studio. Okay, he's the man behind Nerds on Tour. We'll take a break. We'll continue our conversation tonight. We got some stuff to talk about. We want to talk about festivals. Pitchfork, obviously, just wrapped up here in Chicago. Lollapalooza on its way in just under 2 weeks here. They're coming next weekend. And the question that's on the table and the one that we want to throw out to the listener is, do you enjoy going to these festivals? I mean, on paper, it's great. You see 150 bands and they're your favorite bands. But when you're there and you're actually a part of it, do you enjoy the experience?
Does it ever live up to the expectations that you had when you plunked down those three bills
right. For
that three-day pass?
312-981-7200. You could text or call and be a part of the conversation tonight here on The Download. Stay with us. Ladies and gentlemen! Mr. Paul Ryan! Yeah! We're talking music, licensing, the industry here. 312-981-7200. My guest in studio for our monthly segment, Nerds on Tour, Abraham Levitan. He is the man behind Nerds on Tour, the podcast that interviews musicians about the music industry, the business behind the music. He's also a longtime musician here in Chicago, as well as the man behind Piano Power. All right, let's talk about our question that we posed to the audience and the impetus for it. Pitchfork came through town, for all accounts, successful, although I was surprised to see that they didn't have sellouts on a couple of the nights.
That's a big change.
Usually it's packed. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that it's always packed and it's hard to maneuver a festival in a Chicago park. But, you know, your eyes are bigger than your ears, and sometimes when you deal with these festivals, Pitchfork, Lollapalooza, Riot Fest, you see all these bands coming together, and you're like, oh my God, I gotta go see these shows.
Of course, like I went on Friday night, and I can recall that moment where you're sitting in front of your computer, and the lineup goes up, and there are like four or five artists on that night that you're really excited to see, and then you plunk down the money. Now, what happens? As I knock over my water bottle, what happens between that moment and the moment when you are at the show and suddenly you have the energy to see maybe one of those artists, then you have to pee, then you get really hungry, then you'd rather hang out with your friends, and then you might check out 5 minutes of somebody else.
Isn't that essentially the business model of a festival where they're like, well, we got the value end. You paid in, and we got the value end. Now, Pete, you went to Pitchfork as well, and, I mean, you kind of bailed on the last shows on that Sunday sort of for the same reason, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm losing my excitement for festivals in general as I become older, and it's more, I just want to, you know, on Saturday, we're going to go, and I see pictures of people posting, like, you know, who they're seeing. And then I think, oh, my God, I'm missing out. I got to go the next day.
Right.
And then the next day, I'm like, what are we doing?
I do think there's something to that, Pete, is just the idea that we are perhaps aging out. But I still remember that from my 20s, too, the idea that your eyes are bigger than your stomach. And by the time you get to the festival, you're literally seeing one band. And then the rest of it is social, gastronomic, and
standing in line for the porta potty.
Standing in line for the porta potty.
312-981-7200. I'd love to hear a contrarian to that point. I mean, do you enjoy festivals? Do you have a great time? Have you had, you know, tremendous sort of experiences at a Pitchfork, at a Lollapalooza, life-changing kind of stuff? I remember being at Lollapalooza years ago, about 10 years ago, and feeling the same way, where I was just like, I mean, there's something magical about being in Grant Park and being able to look up at the skyline around you while your favorite artist is on stage. There's nothing, and then everything else is sort of like every moment, mm-hmm. every waking moment from that point on, I'm like, how do I get out of here?
Yeah.
Essentially, like, where's the door? What's the easiest way out of here? Is that gate open? Good, because there's going to be a ton of people. How am I going to get? Am I going to get on the L? What am I going to do? Yeah. How am I going to get out of downtown? There's a lot of anxiety, but that just might be me.
Yes.
But that's sort of how I sort of figure all the festivals.
Other questions might include, what's that smell? And what's going on in my stomach?
But I mean, do you really feel? I mean, it'd be quite possible that we're just not the right demographic. We're three, you know, mature gentlemen in studio right now complaining about something that is really geared towards 19-year-olds.
That's what the listeners have to tell us, Justin. I do hope they call in. I hope we have some authentic millennials that call in and just say, shut up, you old fogies. We had so much fun at Pitchfork, and we saw five bands in a row, and there was no fatigue whatsoever.
Are you the kind of guy who goes to a festival and says, all right, I almost like a tourist, where you have six, you know, I'm going to do this at 1:30, we're going to go here, and 2:15, I'm going to be here, and I'm getting my fanny pack out?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm extremely type A. I would definitely have the fanny pack, at least the metaphorical fanny pack.
Sure.
And the app and whatever. And, yeah, of course I have my plan. But you get there, and you realize if you're there with your wife, if you want to stay married, the plan has to go out the window very quickly.
Because after 5 minutes of watching the band, the plan changes.
The plan changes, yes. And I'm terrible with change. I don't like hope or change, just to take it back to the political aspect.
Sure, of course.
But yeah, you must embrace deviating from your plan right away. And if your plan was to maximize the value of your ticket, that's a very difficult thing to do.
I will relate it to an experience that's probably more relatable for the people in our studio and maybe the people that are listening. When you plan a trip to a Disney property, when you go to Disneyland or Disney World, I'm the kind of dad who spent the night before in the Magic Kingdom hotel. You know, son goes to sleep and you're like, okay, so we can start over here at Finding Nemo's submarine. Mm. And what if I did a little jog down real quick, right through Tomorrowland to Frontierland, get Frontierland out of the way, pop, 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 then get ourselves a fast pass and get ourselves in line for Space Mountain.
No, the more I think about it, that comparison is super accurate because every time you go to Six Flags, what happens? You wait in one line for one marquee ride that lasts for 90 seconds.
Right.
And then you're eating elephant ears for 5 hours.
You're at a knockoff Johnny Rockets going, really? It doesn't taste like Johnny Rockets, but I guess it was moderately.
The brand is here.
The brand's here, so I might as well. But yeah, I agree. I feel like I feel festivals are similar to that experience because when I do go to Great America or I'm Six Flags or, you know, I feel like the plan goes out the window as well because there are forces in front of you that just are immovable, and that is that two-hour line for the Superman.
You're talking about large humans.
And large humans.
I think there's also an issue with, I don't like to necessarily be up close any longer. I don't feel the need to be close to an artist.
Right.
I can sit back. But then when you're sitting back, especially at a festival, then you have people that aren't paying attention, and that bugs me. But then,
oh, you're so right. Someone who puts the blanket down and does the, you know, like, I'm going to chill. This is a chill area. We have designated this to be the chill area of Pitchfork. And you're like, no, I'm going to stand by. You pick this. Get up.
At Sunday, I noticed, and maybe they were there all weekend, the people that had the inflatable furniture, like a sectional of inflatable furniture.
That's just a bit gone bad. You know what I mean? 312-981-7200 if you got experiences about.
It is funny, though. I mean, you see these enormous speakers that presumably are very powerful. But if you are not towards the front of the stage, this Jagoff talking next to you is louder than those speakers. Right. How does that happen?
Where you want to go? Try, man. Come on. I told the story on the last week. I went with my wife to see Chance the Rapper last year, and we just went for that show, right? Right at the end. And I was like, I was kind of like, you know, wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready. And I was just like, I can't believe how tight this is, how dangerous this is. There's so many bodies pressed against each other. What is this? And I felt like it. And then at that time, I saw a friend of mine's daughter kind of squeeze through. And my wife, she's like, oh, she was about to say something. Like, no, she don't want to see you. Like, the last person she wants to see right now is you going, hi, oh my gosh, Michelle.
Right.
It's Mrs. Kaufman. I know. All right, let's try Tim. Tim, tell me about your festival experience. Do you go to festivals?
Well, I've been to a few over the years. It's been a while. I think the last big show I probably was at was Crossroads a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But my kids keep bugging me, like, Dad, you got to come with us to a festival. You got to. And I mean, they're 54, they're like 21, and they went to Bonnaroo and ended up coming home early because they couldn't deal with it anymore.
Oh, interesting. So even the kids are kind of, maybe it's not just the, you know, the old timers, but the kids are also getting fed up with the experience. And those are experiences. Thanks, Tim. Those are experiences when you're talking about Bonnaroo where you got to camp.
Well,
I'm not
camping
anywhere when it comes to music.
Let's take it to the logical extreme. Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you actually start interviewing people who were there, there were maybe one-third who actually had a transcendent experience.
Maybe less.
And
one-fifth.
One-fifth.
The rest are like, did we see a pancake place on the way in?
I mean, you know, when you really read the nitty-gritty details of Woodstock and what the weather was like and how much mud there was, and I mean...
Yeah, it probably wasn't a great experience. Hey, if any of our listeners, 312-981-7200. All right, Abraham Levitan in studio. We're doing Nerds on Tour, our monthly look at the issues behind music and the music industry. We'll take a break from the news. We'll come back. We'll continue. We got some other stuff to talk about, including independent record stores. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, playing the worst. 312-981-7200. This is our segment we do every week where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. It's great. I mean, it really is great. A couple of comics, Nelson and Mars, are in studio tonight.
They say that positivity is what ultimately rewards you in life, but this seems to work against that theory.
Well, it works for it, the positivity that comes out of it, the community aspect of all of us communally complaining about the thing, like someone keeping their left turn signal on.
Yeah. So you're building a nation.
I'm building a nation of positivity through negativity. It's spiritual. I don't expect you to understand it.
Over
to Abraham Levitan in studio, talking about issues in the music industry. Selena, you actually love festivals.
I do love festivals, and I can't get enough of them. But and I'm not the right demographic either. But I think, you know, an interesting way to look at it. I mean, when you're not at a set that you were just like dying to see, you can take the cultural anthropologist view of the festival,
right.
You know, or the sociologist. And then, you know, there's the frat boy section vomiting and, you know, well, that's an interesting observation. And you can just be grateful that you're not at that stage of your life.
Right. You can be the Jane Goodall of festivals.
Exactly. Right. Yeah,
Selena, sure. You sound like you're way more laid back than either Justin or me, and it sounds like you can like go to a plan B a lot faster than we can. Like, oh, well, it's not about the music, it's about the anthropology.
Well, it took a few years of, I mean, being a festival veteran, because I was totally like you, like how you were discussing with the Disney experience. And yeah. I, you know, on like Lollapalooza, you have your app and you can pick your schedule and it'll even send you alerts like, oh, you know, better hurry up and get to this stage. But I think part of it is the festivals, it's different from going to the clubs in Chicago during the year where like you're going to see a particular band that you want and That's it. The festival is to discover music. So I totally changed my, you know, how I look at it. I mean, I might have acts that I'm looking forward to seeing, but if you, like, from a smaller stage, you hear something that sounds intriguing, you know, or you don't want to, you know, traipse all the way to the other side of Grant Park mm-hmm. in the rain.
Yeah, right.
Which that's the biggest bummer, I would have to say. It always has to rain at least one day.
Right.
And, like, major rain. Like, they might have to, you know, clear you out and put you in a garage.
Well, summer festivals, you know? Right? All right. Well, thanks, Selena.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. All right. So she's more like the Rick Steves.
She is. Now, Rick Steves, that guy's laid back, too, isn't
right.
he? Now, I mean, but yeah, I mean, Selena, I was teasing her for her laid back nature, but I do think there is something to that
there's
idea of like,
to it, yeah.
There's the club show experience, which is so intense. And somebody like me just wants to have that club show experience five times in a row mm-hmm. or else it feels underwhelming. But then you have Selena saying, discover and be an anthropologist. And maybe that's how you survive as a long-term festival goer.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because festivals are changing almost the concert experience, and you're seeing more and more in the summertime. That's how everybody performs. And again, you know, as we've talked about how touring has become the way that artists are making money, mostly off of merch and the ability to make money directly from their fans. Do festivals, when you're touring with 100 bands or in one spot with 75 bands, do they go again? Does that hurt the band's bottom line? And how does it almost becomes more support, like almost like with streaming, where you're supporting music as opposed to the one-to-one transaction?
Yeah, man, I could answer that question five different ways. But to your point, it does go against a one-to-one transaction with an artist. That to me is still the most natural way to hear music, is that one-to-one transaction where everybody in the room is here because we are Milli Vanilli fans and we are united to see Milli Vanilli only. I'm assuming that they're still touring, which
they are, sure.
I'm sure they are.
Sure.
And that experience, a room full of people that really want to see the same band, you're not going to have everybody around you checking their phone and talking, like Pete was saying was happening at Pitchfork. I mean, that situation exists because you might be surrounded by people for whom seeing this particular band that means the world to you is their plan B or plan C. So I do think it relates to streaming in the sense of it's very casual. You are not having to...
That's what I was going to say. I guess my point being that, you know, the streaming... You know, and we hear about artists being able to give away stuff for free, mixtapes, and even in streaming situations where they're like, hey, we'll just give our product away because the music's free because we're going to make our money on the tour. Mm. Is it almost a festival circuit? Obviously, the organizers are making money, but is it almost continue that trend where you're almost like, this is a show for free, so maybe you'll take a listen to our stream and then we'll come back? And
no, I do think there's an important difference, which is that for some bands, it's the biggest payday they're going to get all
right,
year.
Right.
You know, I was talking a couple months ago with Bonnie Prince Billy on Nerds on Tour, the podcast, ladies and gentlemen, Google Nerds on Tour, about this very point, where he was saying, I hate playing festivals. The only reason I'll say yes is if the paycheck is so big that I would feel awful for my bandmates if I turned it down.
So what do you, I mean, I don't know if you know the specifics, but what is a major Lollapalooza act getting to play at Grant Park? $100,000? $150,000?
I think you're in the ballpark.
Somewhere, again,
I don't really know, but I do think there are indie festivals like Pitchfork, they would pay headliners, I mean, somebody's going to correct me on this for sure, but well over $20,000, $25,000.
So that's not bad if you're a headliner.
Yeah.
But if you're one of the bands that are starting out and this is your first Pitchfork and you're playing at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, that you're not getting $20,000.
I'm sure you'll get used and abused. I mean, to put it in a super small scale terms, my band, when I first moved to Chicago, our dream was to play the Metro. Right? I mean, that was like the ultimate for a local band, was to play the Metro. And it finally happened just before we broke up, of course. Just we're hitting our peak.
Yeah, right. That was it.
And it was like a Wednesday night, four local bands, and everybody got, I think, either 50 or 100 bucks. So it was like, welcome to Chicago, kid. You did it.
You made it. You made it.
So, yeah, I'm sure that stuff happens with Pitchfork. I mean, to Pitchfork's credit, they have a budget. They have to get the biggest bang for their buck.
It's not on them. I'm just saying the bands have to look at festivals in a different way since they're not getting paid.
I don't think it follows the streaming analogy that closely, because I think there are plenty of bands that get paid majorly compared to what they make in a club show. I mean, when I was playing with Bobby Kahn back in the mid-2000s, legendary Chicago avant-garde artist, WGN audience, we got paid enough to fly to Oslo, Norway, play one show, and fly back home. And this was a band of seven people.
Wow.
So, and this was for Bobby Kahn, who was not raking it in across the country. So yeah, I do think festivals have
can make it happen for
serious artists. Paydays for artists too.
Abraham Levitan, he's the man behind Nerds on Tour. You can find that podcast on iTunes, and also you can Google it, like you said. We'll continue our conversation here about the music and music industry, because we need to talk about record stores and the big news that came out of a major label essentially cutting off small record stores from their product, and what impact that's going to have on the short-term lifespan of some independent record stores, even in Chicago. Abraham in studio. Stay with us. This is Download here on 720 WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me, Abraham Levitan. We do this once a month. We talk about issues in music and the music industry. He's the man behind Nerds on Tour, the podcast where he interviews musicians about the business of music. You can find that on Google, iTunes, all the places that podcasts live. Okay, Abraham, so let's talk about this story that came out. It was kind of a small story. Not a lot of people looked at it, but it really has a significant impact on the way that record stores do their business.
Yes. So what just came down the pike, Warner Music, which I guess had this deal in place for years but was never actually enforcing it, has decided to enforce the idea that in order for a record store to continue to do business with Warner Music, which controls many, many major labels, that store needs to put in orders that total at least $10,000 a year.
So they need to essentially order 10,000 pieces of Warner Music
$10,000 worth of Warner product
per year.
And
a lot of record stores, they just don't work at that volume.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't, I think in the past, you just could kind of plug along and continue to relate to them. Now you get cut off completely, which essentially means that if somebody goes in for, you know, a Father's Day gift and wants this particular major label artist, you will not be able to depend on the mom and pop shop to do that. And if you weren't doing it already, you would just default to making that purchase on Amazon
instead. Warner doesn't really care. They don't have a firm investment into independent record stores. They've done this throughout their career. Before it was Amazon, it was big box stores like Best Buy or Tower Records. They didn't have much to do with independent record stores to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And it all smacks to me of this kind of like 80-20 corporate philosophy of the idea of like, well, if something's too much work, then just cut that sector out of your business entirely. And that it just seems like there was some senior vice president that got replaced by a different senior vice president. And they were saying, you know what? We could really push our margins a little higher if we cut out all these little stores that are so much work.
So, you know, obviously this is something that could be mirrored or, replicated by other major labels to do the same kind of thing, where they want to have margins, or they want to have sort of prereqs for what it takes to be in business with Warner or Sony or something like that. Is it something that you know should be a harbinger for the end of the relationship between the music industry and independent record stores?
I don't know. I mean, to me, there's like the tipping point in the consumer's mind, right? Where like a consumer is not going to sit there and be like, okay, now I want to get this new Springsteen album. Okay, Springsteen is on Columbia Records. Now, which conglomerate is that associated
with?
Now, were they the ones that had the relationship severed with my local mom and pop? No, that's a ridiculous thing to expect from a consumer. So at a certain point, if enough of these things happen, the consumer will simply say, I cannot get big name artists at my mom and pop shop anymore. And the minute that that happens, you really are going to have record stores that are making all their money by selling, you know, a few consignment copies of a local band. And that is not a business plan, because I feel like the big record store cash cows are always like box sets.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Someone coming in and dropping more than $12.
Yeah. But those big holiday purchases where it's like, okay, I'm going to go in December and satisfy everybody on my shopping list and spend $700. How are you going to do that by buying only indie artists when you're talking about your dad, your uncle, and your grandpa?
Right. And that's always the way independent record stores have worked. They've always been able to give you the product that is more mainstream and be able to support some of the independent artists and the stuff that you don't usually find in stores. That's really the eclectic part of product.
For sure. Yeah, you go in for the Springsteen album, which may or may not be a gift. I'm just putting this out there. But you stay for the recommendations from the record store employee. You stay for maybe hearing something on the turntable that you hadn't heard before. And so it's that kind of like spontaneous combustion that wouldn't happen if you knew you couldn't go to that store to get a Springsteen record.
Are we at the point, though, in 2016 that people who are going to specialized independent record stores like Reckless or other stores in Dusty Groove's, any of the stores, they know they're not going for the Springsteen record, right? They're already past that point. I feel like that ship has sailed. They're going in there for specific bands that they follow or to support that culture or to support that independent business.
I think that's true, but I also think that's a real bummer for Reckless Records and other stores like Reckless Records, because I think the profit margin just goes way down. I mean, not that it was ever great to begin with, the margin goes way down when you are living and dying off of indie purchases only.
Right. So is there a possibility, though, as you know, the Warner Music catalogs will be replaced? Is there a possibility that
they'll be replaced with used VHS tapes, by the way, just to make
exactly
that clear.
Exactly right. But is there a way for another market to kind of bubble up? Does the independent record store need major labels anymore? Could they find other ways? Could a third party kind of business come in that would get them the Warner Brothers stuff? I mean, are there options here for record stores to, I guess, develop into something different?
Well, I mean, let's look at it from a pure economic model, right? Because this is what's really going to captivate our audience. If we do involve a middleman, let's say,
right.
Who's going to say, okay, mom and pop shop,
come out to my truck.
Out to my truck, because I do way more than $10,000 worth of business with Warner, because I drive around every independent store in the country and sell this stuff out of my truck.
Sure.
Then the only real impact is, okay, we're working with a middleman who's charging us $3 per record. So we just bump up the price $3 per record on everything we sell. I think that's reasonable. I think you might have consumers that don't notice that. So that's kind of the unsexy end to this story, is that it's just
an
economic story.
The hard part too about those businesses is they become nostalgia trips. And that's not necessarily great for bottom line. And secondly, if the newer kind of generations of musicians, the independent musicians we've talked about in this segment, that are doing things on their own without record labels, they're not pressing anything. They're streaming. They're putting MP3s out. So the record company, or the record store can't even go to them and be like, hey, let's just have a relationship where you give us the LPs or you give us the CDs, because they're not even they've bypassed it entirely.
Yeah, I mean, let's cut to the chase. Owning a small record store is an extremely hard business. Brutal. The battles that musicians are fighting right now are don't stream me, download me. Like, that is the new frontier.
Right.
Like, the frontier keeps getting smaller and smaller.
So where do they go? Is there a possibility that they become the flag wavers for an independent culture? Is there a possibility that the record store does something that makes them more of center of a community as opposed to sell product?
I hope so. I think events like Record Store Day. I'm not sure how much of the audience is familiar with that already, yeah, but I think it's every spring. There's a day nationwide where every independent record store is having special promos and limited edition releases and all this stuff, and that gets foot traffic in. I mean, yeah, I think the dream with all of that stuff is to become a center of the community. And I mean, my immediate family, my wife and two-year-old, we went to Nashville a few months ago, and you see what Jack White is doing with Third Man Records. And that's not really a record store. That's more of a museum that sells stuff, you know, and it's like curiosity shop, and you can like or dislike Jack White's aesthetic. But he's clearly thinking of this as a record store with quotes around it, more of a museum of culture.
Right.
With things that are for sale.
Which where some of these businesses may have to go, and they are. I mean, I think of Dusty Groove and some of the other record stores that they're not in the game of selling the new Bruce Springsteen record. They're in the game of really catering to someone who wants to come in and find that LP from 1974. Or, you know, like, essentially, when I just walked in, I can't remember what's the name of the record store that's on Milwaukee and Wicker Park that's just next to the Dave Eggers shop, the Spy Shop. Anyway, it's right there.
I don't leave my house anymore except to come see you. So.
It's all LPs. But the point being that's their thing. It's T-shirts and posters and LPs, and you start flipping through, and you're like, this is amazing stuff. This is almost like found sound type stuff. It's really interesting, and I like it. But I didn't think, oh man, I need to find the new. I hope they got the new Pearl Jam. You know, that wasn't a thought that got in my head.
Right, and not to get too Californian on you, but a lot of it has to do with, do you create an environment that welcomes consumers to have this sense of discovery and exploration when you walk in, or is it a place that puts the consumer in that transactional frame of mind? I think Dusty Groove is a great example of a store that just has that magic sparkle to it. And you walk in there and you feel like, why don't I have more records? Why am I not discovering all these obscure releases from 1974? What's wrong with me? My life has to change today. And you can have that beautiful experience there. And I do think that is the future of independent record stores, is to pay attention to aesthetics and the way that it makes people feel to be in that space.
Well, they're going to have to without the relationships with major music, I guess, if they're going to cut them off or not spending enough money.
For sure.
That sounds very mob-like.
It does.
Doesn't it? It's like, you didn't pay enough money this month.
It does.
Well, then you're not going to get a product.
And surely the record industry has never had any relationship with the mob.
That's a different segment here on the Nerds on Tour. All right. So this week we were able to cover a couple of things, which is good. We talked about licensing for Donald Trump and the RNC. Interesting little fight. We talked about festivals, why we go, and if it's worth it anymore. We talked about if it's worth it for the artists to be on stage, and then we wrapped up with independent record stores and whether or not they need to change the way they do business based on the way that the music industry is kind of pushing them out. Make sense?
I think we did so well, Justin. I am hiring 2 to 3 more instructors for Piano Power.
Okay.
If you are a young college grad who is just moving to Chicago to start a music career, why don't you Google Piano Power? You know how to use the internet. You're a millennial. I want to hear from you tonight.
Abraham Levitan is the man behind Nerds on Tour, the podcast that talks to musicians about the music industry. He's also the man behind his company, Piano Power. Abraham, good to talk to you. See you next month.
Thanks, Justin.